Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Out to Channing Frye for three, puts it in. Largest lead of the game. Loses it to James. Two on one. Jefferson back to James. Lance Stephenson gets inside. Nice soft touch. Lance Stephenson nails it. Stephenson sees it opening left-handed, lays it in. George fakes, kicks it out. Teague for three, knocks it down. Jeff Teague makes it a four-point game. Teague steps back, three-pointer, puts it in. And the first lead for the Pacers. James on the drive, to the rim. Irving splits the defense. Elbow jumper's good. George, long three-pointer. It's good. Paul George. James hovering, goes to double team. They look to get it out of George's hands. 4 seconds to go. Miles puts up the jumper. Won't go. Game over. Cavs survive.
I thought overall defensively we were pretty good, just outside of the loose balls they got, scored the basketball, offensive rebounds, putbacks, the 50-50 balls that we didn't get to, they scored on. Just clean those things up, it'd have been a different game. 11 turnovers for 19 points, and then missing 13 free throws wasn't good for us either. We found a way to, pull the game out, and, we'll be better.
Offensively, we kind of got a little stagnant, started playing a little bit isolation, which we're very good at. No matter what happened, we came out with the win. And in a series, I think you get better with time.
They almost was baiting me to throw that. Richard Jefferson was kind of cat and mousing it. And I told Lance he had to flash up. That would have been the ball game right there. Richard can't guard both of those, CJ and Lance. But he didn't do so. I gave it up, to soften him up and try to get it back. I talked to CJ about it. Situations like that, I got to get the last shot.
Utah has a timeout. Gets it across half court. Won't use the timeout. 5 seconds left. Joe Johnson with four. Johnson with two. Drives in. Puts it up. Gets the bounce at the gun. And the Jazz win game one. ISO Joe.
Honestly, I was supposed to take the ball out. I think Faye just kind of took the ball out and I was open. I seen George coming trying to get the ball where CP was chasing him. So I just brought the ball up. I remember Joe Ingles setting the pick. Got Jamal Crawford on me, and I just seen the clock going down, so I knew I had to make a play. I just wanted to get as close as I could to the basket. It's a good thing it went down.
Our second half was just abysmal. We didn't play with any pace, any rhythm, any movement. We got to figure out how to get a better rhythm, better pace. A lot of that led to tough shots, challenge shots. We were just totally out of rhythm in the second half.
I thought it was a really hard-fought game. We really had to battle. It's an excellent team that plays its best basketball in the fourth quarter, and I thought we really battled and fought. Did a good job on the glass. Our effort all night long was terrific. Our bench was excellent.
Credit where credit is due to the Bulls. It's really hard circumstances for those guys, specifically Isaiah. Perspective of it all, hit you in a hard way, and not only proud of the effort, but the way they supported him and couldn't help but be inspired by his play.
I just try to find ways to, exploit the defense. I just try to get to the basket. I think I missed my first six or seven shots or whatever, but I knew that wasn't going to go on for long, and so I just continue to, stay with it. But I just try to make the right play.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, my goodness gracious me, oh my. Welcome to the Monday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Hope you had a great weekend, a great Easter weekend. Had beautiful weather really pretty much for the entire weekend. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Maybe get out and swing the sticks a little bit. Maybe get out to Brandywine a little bit. Yeah, I'll tell you more about that later on. That's for later in the show. But my, oh my, really great weekend. I'm so glad to get back. Behind the microphones, we can talk about everything that you had that you saw over the weekend. How about the Tigers in their first series showdown with the Injuns, the defending American League Central and American League champions, the team that just dominated them last year with an ease of victory that really you can't even put into words what the Indians did to the Tigers essentially all season last year. This time, the Tigers face off with the Indians in Cleveland, and they take two out of three. From the Tribe, the only team apparently that the Indians can hit in that homestand, the only pitcher is the Tigers' ace, Justin Verlander. Verlander got knocked around, gave up a career-high 9 earned runs in Saturday's game, but he was the sandwich in the middle, or excuse me, he was the middle, the meat in the middle of the sandwich of much better pitching for the Tigers against the Indians, because the Indians were locked down on both Friday and on Sunday. So that's where things are as far as baseball goes right now. Really, really impressive start to the season, I think, by all accounts, for the Detroit Tigers, not so much for the very, very sleepy Indians bats, including some of their most expensive bats. So right now, as things stand here, starting on this Monday the 17th, Tigers are in first place by a game over the Twins, a game and a half over the White Sox, 2 over the Royals, and yes, a 3-game bulge over the defending AL champions, who are in last place at 5-7. So how about that? I can't do Mel Allen, but you get the idea there. So we're going to talk a little bit about the baseball games. But we are also, of course, going to talk an awful lot about basketball. The Cavaliers have a 1-game-to-none lead in the Eastern Conference, 2-7 first-round matchup. It probably shouldn't be that way. They didn't deserve to win. I'm not going to try to make things look or sound better than they are. They had a 12-point lead late in the third, going into the fourth, complete control of the game, and they let complete control get away from them in that game, in part, once again, because they can't defend. The non-defending NBA champion Cleveland Cavaliers can't seem to stop anybody. And in fact, the Pacers had a two-point lead in the very, very late stages of that game before the Cavaliers were able to retake the lead and then survive not a Paul George jump shot, but a C.J. Miles jump shot. The go-ahead could be, would be, might be game-winning shot from C.J. Miles that was off the mark. Should have gone to Paul George. I think they all pretty much agree that it should have gone to Paul George, and the ball did not go to Paul George. You heard it in the montage. And, Jim, I don't have that there. If you can play that for me. I want to hear that Paul George liner again. And I'll tell you what, this isn't without controversy. Let me say that. The Paul George comment at the end of the game about how I've got to have the last shot. I've got to have the last shot. I can't let that get away from me like that. In truth, it's not like it's that simple. Bottom line is, Paul George isn't a great last shot taker. Paul George, in fact, is very, very LeBron-esque when it comes to last second, you know, game winning or go ahead shot theatrics. It's not his bag. Paul George, come to find out, do you know that he is 0-15? Or excuse me, not 0-and, beg pardon. 0-15 on go-ahead shots with under 20 seconds left in his career. He doesn't make those. Now, was he right that he should have been the one to take that shot instead of C.J. Miles? Yes, even though he's 0-15. He's still the superstar on that team. They have to defer, and that means C.J. Miles or anybody else has to defer to Paul George to take that shot. By the way, in the game, game one on Saturday, Paul George was 6-8 from three-point range. 6-8. So if there is going to be somebody to take that shot in that game, you'd say it should be Paul George, simply because he was hot, but also overall. Because, I mean, let's think about it. You know, C.J. Miles, Paul George. C.J. Miles, Paul George. Forget about 0-15. Nobody was thinking about 0-15. The ball's got to be, I mean, there has to be a pecking order, right? There just has to be a pecking order. And that was out of order for the Indiana Pacers. And the Cavaliers were huge beneficiaries of that. Because I have a strong suspicion that Paul George, the way he was shooting the basketball, would have knocked down that game-winning shot. He would have knocked that down, not C.J. Miles, but Paul George, if he had taken it, would have knocked it down. And I don't know why C.J. Miles is dribbling away from Paul George. When Paul George gives the ball to him, comes right to him to get it back so he can make the game-winning attempt. And C.J. goes left, drives hard, stops, pops, misses badly pretty much too, and the Cavaliers escape. It was not a good win by the Cavaliers. It was an ugly win, to say the very, very least. Paul George should have had a chance to win that game. Cush hit it.
they almost was baiting me to throw that. You know, Richard Jefferson was kind of cat and mousing it. And I told Lance he had to flash up. That would have been the ball game right there. You know, Richard can't guard both of us, CJ and Lance. But he didn't do so. I gave it up, you know, to soften him up and try to get it back. I talked to CJ about it. Situations like that, I got to get the last shot.
Okay. There's a little bit more than that, but that's at the end of the day, he does have to have the last shot. And he did say that he has to have the last shot. And, you know, the fact that, you know, nobody knew that on his team. Look, Paul George is the man. There isn't a 1B. He's 1A and 1B. What I mean by that is, for example, in Golden State, in Oakland, quite obviously, option number one or option number two on taking a game-winning shot there is going to be Kevin Durant or Steph Curry. They're going to be options 1A and 1B in one order or the other, right? Because they're both incredible shooters. Kevin Durant is one of the best shooters in the history of the sport. So is Steph Curry. And they both can hit clutch shots. There's a 1A and a 1B. Nobody's going to be saying, I should have gotten that shot in Oakland if somebody misses it. Nobody would complain if Durant took it. Nobody would complain if Curry took it. Hell, chances are nobody would complain if Klay Thompson took it, to be quite honest. There's no 1A, or excuse me, there's a 1A and there's a 1B, and maybe even a 1C with Thompson. In a place like Indiana, there is no 1B. It's just Paul George. He is 1A, 1B, and 1C. He takes that shot. In Cleveland, there is a 1A. And it isn't LeBron James. 1A is Kyrie Irving to take the last shot, as he did with that clutch championship-winning dagger in Game 7 against Golden State. He takes that shot, but nobody would be mad at LeBron if he took it. It's just that we know his history. He's not good at it. He's not a clutch shot maker. He's the most dominant player in basketball. He puts up those massive numbers, 32, 13, and I think 6. Was his assist line on Saturday. So he's the most dominant player from, you know, start to finish. But when it's time to finish, that's Kyrie Irving's job. But you could say there is at least a 1B in LeBron. If he took it, nobody would be too upset. And in fact, if they wanted to get the ball to J.R. Smith with the money on the line, not too many people would be upset. But there isn't that in Indiana. So Paul George is right in that regard. The Cavaliers dodged a major, major bullet. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know that they're going to dodge another one. Now, does that mean I think they're going to lose? Of course, I don't think they're going to lose the series. In fact, I think I picked them in 5. Jim Kushlinger earlier in this, or I should say during our preview session last week, we talked about this, and you said it's either going to be the Cavaliers in a sweep or a long, hard, arduous 6 or 7-game series.
Yep.
And I picked it right in between the two. I think it's going to be a 5. I think the one that that Golden State was going to, or Golden State, Indiana was going to win is probably going to be game 3, as I predicted. But I'll tell you what, if they would have won in game 1 and Miles had made that shot, or if he had gotten it to George and George had made that shot, then I would have changed my prediction of 5 to 6 or 7 the way you had predicted, because all of the momentum would be Indiana's and all of the question marks would be on the Cavaliers. And in fact, even in victory, they still are. After the way they closed the season, 23-23, not looking like defending champions in any way, shape, or form, there are still questions on them now because it took that missed C.J. Miles shot in order for the Cavaliers to get a 1-0 lead. I still think there are plenty of question marks for the Cavs, even going into game 2 tonight, up 1-0, Kush.
Oh, I absolutely do, too. I mean, even though Ty Lue was saying, hey, we like some of the things our defense was able to do, he still nearly blew a 10-point midway through the fourth quarter lead. Honestly, when they went up 12 at the end of the third quarter,
right,
and then got it back to 10 midway through the fourth, I'm like, okay, guys, finally, you know, you're doing what you're supposed to do. And they let that one trickle all the way back to the point where Indiana actually had a lead, honestly, late in that game, as we know.
Yeah, took a 2-point lead.
So it's not there yet. You know, obviously it's going to take a few games to get the malaise, the whatever the heck mentally, in addition to the physical aspects like the poor defensive play, among others, it's going to take a few games for them to get that, flush that stuff out of their system. And that's part of the reason I said, Cavs will win, but it'll be a harder-fought six-game series. And after watching that one the other day, I'm not changing my opinion yet. Can't.
Yeah, I mean, they were very fortunate to escape with that victory, no doubt about it. I think they will get a victory in Game 2, and I think it will be a little bit more convincing tonight. I really do. How? Because I think they really had, you know, the smack in the face of reality there that they can't jack around and just expect to cruise over these guys. Now, I do think that that first loss in their playoff season will indeed come in Game 3, the first game in Indiana, as kind of is you know, often the pattern. When you don't get a sweep by the home team or the higher-seeded team, and it is a case of a five-game series, it's almost always Game 3 that you lose. And I can see that happening still. But, you know, nothing. I would put no significant amount of money. No money at all that really was, you know, that mattered to me at all. I would not put on this, on really anything happening in this series or beyond, because these Cavaliers are, quite frankly, just not very consistent. And they're not very believable. They're not very believable that the switch has been flipped. You know, LeBron made his announcement that he's going zero dark 30-23 for the playoffs. He's in his now. I'm going to block out and shut off all my social media stuff, so he's going to be all locked in. You know what? It's not just about him. And he was pretty well locked in, by the way. He had a great game in Game 1. But you know what? There still is no defense in that team. Zero dark 30-23 doesn't make you a better defensive team. It's just that simple. And they're giving up too many points to teams like Indiana. Can you imagine if they're fortunate enough to get to a Golden State, what kind of havoc that the Warriors' offense could do to the Cavaliers' defense? And I know that's way down the road, so we'll get more into that as we go. All right, a couple of other things NBA-wise in the first round. And obviously there are eight series that are now underway, so we can't get to all of them, but I do want to talk a little bit about last night. Jim, I can't remember, did you say Westbrook? You picked Westbrook for your MVP, yes?
I was still leaning that direction, yes.
Yes, when we had that conversation.
Right. Okay,
and I think I almost kind of talked you out of it and into James Harden. Last night was, and obviously it doesn't matter because we know it's a regular season award. All the votes had to be turned in, so... Don't get me wrong, I'm not going to try to rewrite this whole thing at all. But last night was an example of what I was talking about. I really fully believed that the Rockets' season, having been eight games better and being guided every single step of the way by James Harden, the man who handles the ball, even though he's listed as the two guard, he is the point guard, he is the playmaker, he is the best shooter. He is more than the straw that stirs the drink. He does just virtually everything. And what he did last night in the first showdown with Russell Westbrook since their two historic seasons, Westbrook, of course, being the second player in history to average a triple-double, breaking Oscar Robertson's record for number of triple-doubles in a season with 42. All of that happened, and that's fine. But all... James Harden did was come within 1 point of the all-time record set by Nate Tiny Archibald in 1972-1973 for the most combined scored on and assisted on points in a single season in NBA history. And he came within 1.9 rebounds of averaging the same triple-double that that Westbrook did. So they got their first head-to-head showdown on. And much as I kind of expected, James Harden took control. And you might be able to say, well, he's got a much... He doesn't have a much better team. Is it a better team than the Thunders? Yeah, it is. I won't dispute that it's a better team. But it is not like he's playing for the Warriors the way Durant is. And Russell Westbrook is trying to lead the Nets.
Right.
Okay? It's not that... You know what I mean? It's yeah. not that cut and dried. It's not that black and white. There is some room for comparison here. Looking at the Rockets roster, looking at the Thunder's roster, neither one of them is an all-star team. James Harden has Patrick Beverley. He has Clint Capella. He has Trevor Ariza. And he has Ryan Anderson in his starting lineup. That's not the defending champions there. That's not the Warriors from champions from 2 years ago. That's not an all-star lineup. His bench, Harrell Williams, Hilario Brown, Gordon Williams. You know, again, and Lou Williams is a player. Lou Williams can score. He's big off the bench. He was, of course, the best player on the Lakers, best scorer on the Lakers to come over. But that's not like, you know, when you compare that to Westbrook's group, it's not, you know, like I said, something that's a, not a fair comparison. Westbrook with Oladipo and Gibson and Robertson and Adams as his start, with the rest of his starting five. The bench including Grant, Sabonis, McDermott, Cantor, Enes Kanter, of course, who can play big at times. Abrines, Kristen. It's not like that. So I think it's a little bit more of an apples-to-apples comparison than a lot of people want to believe that it is. Well, the numbers were just what the numbers kind of are. James Harden was 13 out of 28, so a hair below 50%. He did not have a good game shooting 3 points. He was 3 for 11 from the three line.
Both were 3 for 11, actually.
That, I expect that, though, from Westbrook.
Right.
Because Harden is a better three-point shooter.
Exactly.
But Harden had 37 points, 9 assists, 7 rebounds, and this is the key statistic. He turned it over only 2 times. Turned it over 2 times. He was plus 22 in the plus-minus category. Russell Westbrook, captain triple-double, was 6 of 23 shooting, as Jim mentioned, also 3 of 11 from distance. He had his 22 points. He had his 11 rebounds. He had 7 assists. But here's the number. 9 turnovers. He turned it over 9 times from the point guard position. He was a minus 25 on the plus minus. The bottom line is, as great as Russell Westbrook is, as great as he plays, as much as he makes BFFs with the basketball. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, Russell Westbrook in an interview over the weekend explained who his best friend on the court is. He was talking about whether or not he could put his friendship with James Harden aside for this series. And he said, my best friend is the basketball. My best friend has always been the basketball. It's been that way since I was about 10 years old, he said. When I'm on the court, my best friend is the ball. And I don't know if he thinks that's a very positive thing to say to the press or not, but to me, it's an eye-opener. Because his best friend isn't his teammate. His best friend isn't his coach. His best friend is the basketball. It's me and the ball, and that's all. And guess what? That's probably a pretty good explanation as to why Russell Westbrook took 1,000 more shots with his best friend, that basketball, than the next highest shooter in Oklahoma City. That might explain why Russell Westbrook took 400 more shots than anybody else in the NBA. Because he and his best buddy are just doing their thing. His best buddy is the ball. He doesn't make many guys around him better. The assist totals, you know, averaging 10 assists, notwithstanding, he doesn't make a lot of guys better. There is no doubt in my mind that James Harden has made the Rockets players better. That's just the way that it is. James Harden is a leader. They follow him. It's not just that he averages 1.5 assists more a game, I think it is, than Russell Westbrook. It's just that he makes them all better. He makes them feel like they're contributing. It's not just the James Harden show. Whereas in Oklahoma City, it's the Russell Westbrook show. It's the James Harden and friends show. He's got friends that aren't just the basketball. And I think last night was a prime example of why. Even though, again, I say this again, Kush, that they cannot wait until last night or to see how this series ends in order to cast their MVP votes. Those with the vote have to cast it by the end of the regular season. But last night is a prime example of why I cast my proverbial vote, since I don't have one, for James Harden over Russell Westbrook. What'd you think?
And I could certainly see that argument. I mean, for all those favoring Harden in this ongoing debate that we've all had, then, yeah, even though it can't count for voting, et cetera, and so on, yesterday was kind of an interesting prime example of why those who are on the Harden side are thinking that. And I love you pointing out the turnover margin. I mean, that one is huge, especially because of the disparity, 9 for Westbrook and 2 for James Harden. I almost also wonder at the same time, you know, and this isn't to diminish Harden and his...
And you know why his turnovers are always so high, right? I mean, because it's that whole whirling dervish style of his, sure, that I've talked about in the past.
Yes.
You know, that Tasmanian devil kind of way he plays. You just can't play at the breakneck speed with which he plays. And again, I can't criticize it because he has done some amazing things with it. But you can't play at that breakneck speed without getting out of control and without losing control of the ball. And again, without turning it over. And those things end up costing,
yep,
you, you know, far more than a lot of people realize. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, because you're right. You play out of control like that enough, then the laws of basketball physics, if you will eventually even that out, and you'll cough up some costly and boneheaded, like, kind of turnovers as you go along. I also wonder, too, at the same time, because, you know, we've had this discussion, and for obvious reasons, but the other thing I saw, because thinking about this whole weekend, I thought we were going to come in here Monday, you know, we talk about the Cavs game, and then spend a lot of time, you know, specifically on this game, which actually at the end of the day turned out to, scoreboard-wise, to be a blowout when you had some very interesting upsets around in the other rounds. But on this subject specifically, and I wonder how many voters, as who've already casted their ballots, as you pointed out, for this, if they don't want to go to Harden, and it's not the triple-double thing, I wonder how much Mike D'Antoni's coaching job with this team, which to me is incredible. He's, you know, there's an award we haven't talked much about, Coach of the Year. To me, it goes to Mike D'Antoni in Houston for what he's been able to do with that team that I think was projected at like 43 wins back at the start of this season.
Brad Stevens is going to get an awful lot of love for that,
yes,
too, winning the Eastern Conference over the defending champions the way that he did.
Yeah, and that's why I think he's going to edge it out. But I just wonder how much of that is Harden taking it to the next level at the same time because of the system Mike D'Antoni's been putting into place this year in Houston, which has clearly worked for them.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, you know what? Mike D'Antoni is the perfect coach for James Harden.
Absolutely.
Because Harden likes to play up-tempo but not out of control. He likes to play up-tempo, likes to get into the break a lot the way Mike D'Antoni likes to do. And Mike D'Antoni's coaching style and philosophy does not require, for lack of a better way of saying it, a lot of defense.
And we know
and
Harden
that's not
play
James
D.
Harden. What's that?
And we know Harden doesn't really play.
And James Harden doesn't like playing a lot of defense. So it's a perfect game. It's like we're going to try to outscore teams. You know, we'll come back down. We'll do what we can on the defensive end. And obviously, he and Beverly and others did a pretty good job on Russell Westbrook enforcing turnovers. But, you know, which is a kind of defense, obviously. But, yeah, it's an up-tempo, fast-paced, high-scoring, high-shot-volume type of game that D'Antoni coaches, as we've known from all of his years, yeah, in the NBA, everywhere he's ever been, and it plays right into the strengths of James Harden. All right, so really a lot to get into still on the NBA. Got to talk a little bit about Charles Barkley and Isaiah Thomas. Isaiah Thomas, as you know, played one day after his younger sister was killed in a single car crash. Just an absolutely horrific moment in time, I'm sure, for Isaiah Thomas. Most people expected he wouldn't play at all. One day later, most just thought that couldn't happen. But he did. He played, and the Celtics, number one seed in the East, were upset by the Bulls. And needless to say, Isaiah Thomas was very, very emotional. He showed some emotion on the sideline. Charles Barkley said some things about that emotion that, well, let's just say rubbed a whole lot of people a whole lot of bad ways. Many people wanting TNT to part ways now with Charles Barkley. I want to talk a little bit about that as we continue as well. But right now, I want to talk to you about something a little more fun, and that is fantasy sports on FanDuel.com. Have you tried fantasy golf yet? It is so much fun, and it's so easy to play fantasy golf. If you love watching golf, just make it more fun by putting your own team together and winning cash when you watch your team score. That's right. Pick a contest, choose your team players, watch it live, and win cash prizes. There's something for everyone, and it's so cheap, too. I mean, honestly, contests all over the place starting at just a dollar. Hurry and make sure to submit your lineup before tee off every Thursday morning, and then you can win as your golfers score eagles and pars and birdies and everything else. It's a fantastic way to enjoy golf. But then, of course, there is daily fantasy basketball and daily fantasy baseball, and we're playing fantasy baseball here at 106.5. The Ticket, there's a new contest every day. You can play as often as you want or as little as you want. You can play in the big tournaments or just play against your friends. Just pick your team. Like, for example, yesterday, yeah, I picked Carlos Carrasco. We had him in the lineup. Carlos Carrasco is one of my favorite Indians. I've talked about him all the time. And I had him in my lineup, and I got good results for the most part. 6 2/3, only 2 runs allowed, 4 hits. He did walk 5, but he was a hard luck loser, as you know. because the Indians' bats are still silent. Speaking of silent bats, Jose Bautista was also in the lineup, just a hunch, seeing when Joey Bats could crank some out. He was 0 for 4 with a walk. But, you know, you do this every day like we do, and some days you're going to hit, some days you're going to miss, but the fun is watching baseball, knowing that your guys are winning you cash. Over 2.5 million players, in fact, have won cash playing fantasy sports on FanDuel, and we're going to help you get started. If you're a new user, get the FanDuel Combo 5-Pack valued at up to $50. Five free entries to a combination of 50-50 beginner contests. Just finish in the top half to win cash. To get your five free entries valued at up to $50, go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and enter the promo code France, F-R-A-N-T-Z. That's FanDuel.com, promo code France, F-R-A-N-T-Z. Got to spell it right or you don't get the five free entries. Void where prohibited. Join us for fantasy sports at FanDuel.com. And join us right back after this as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Hope you're having an outstanding Monday. Thanks for being with us for the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. I should probably give you the phone numbers in case you have something to say. 866-240-1065 is the number to dial us. 866-240-1065. Hey, you know, we got a cool new contest going on right now, too. Toledo's ESPN 106.5 The Ticket and Buck Brothers. A chance for you to win a new driveway for your home. It's the ugliest driveway contest. Just head over to our website, 1065theticket.com, and upload a picture of your ugly driveway. All right? Contest ends in about a month, May 14th at midnight. It's brought to you by Buck Brothers and Toledo Sports Leader, ESPN 1065 The Ticket. Very cool thing. So by all means, check it out at 1065theticket.com and upload your ugly driveway. I can't wait to see some of these pictures. It's going to be an awful lot of fun. So there's a very cool contest coming your way. Coming up at about 4:05, we're going to talk about baseball, basketball, and football all with one guy. Our friend sports writer Dennis Manilow is going to talk to us about the Tigers taking the Indians apart 2 out of 3 in Cleveland this past weekend. Talk to him also about game number 2 of the Eastern Conference Series, first round series between the Cavaliers and the Pacers that we discussed a little bit. And then also, you know, we're what? How many days away from the draft, Jim Quishlin?
The draft is next Thursday for round 1.
So that put next Thursday, so not this Thursday.
Right.
So 10 days. 11 days. 11 days, right?
Yeah. No,
I'm doing
10,
the math here.
10, 27th.
27, so 10 days.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. So anyway, draft is coming, and of course the Browns are on the clock, and there's still a lot of questions as to whether or not they're going to want a quarterback or they're going to want the pass rusher Myles Garrett. I don't want Myles Garrett. I made that clear, and I'll continue to say that, and I'll talk to Maniloff about that too. But we'll get into the draft a little bit as well. Everybody's got mock drafts out. But I want to stay in the NBA right now, and I want to find out your opinion on this. I gave you the phone number, 866-240-1065. I want to find out how out of bounds, if you will, you believe Charles Barkley really was. When he was on the TNT NBA tip-off show before the Celtics game against the Bulls, and Isaiah Thomas was on the sidelines in a very emotional moment, in a very emotional state. It was during the shoot-around, and he was on the sidelines being consoled by Avery Bradley as he cried. I don't want to use the word uncontrollably, but it wasn't, you know, just a little sniffle. He was crying. His sister was killed in a car crash the day before. It's an extraordinarily difficult thing to try to understand how he felt. I can't put my mind in or put it into words how he must have felt. But it was obviously very emotional, and I don't think anybody would have blamed him. Anybody would have blamed Isaiah Thomas if he'd have not played in this game. He wasn't in an emotional state of mind that allowed him to compete and play in this game, right? Charles Barkley felt like he probably shouldn't be. And in essence, if he can't control his emotions in pregame, then it's not probably a good look that he goes and even plays that game. Here's what Charles Barkley said. Now listen for yourself and kind of evaluate it. And decide whether or not you think what Charles Barkley did was below the belt, out of bounds, pick your metaphor there, and that he should apologize for it. Or in some fans' cases, they're saying he should flat out be fired by TNT for such egregious commentary about a man, Isaiah Thomas, whose sister was just killed. Listen to Charles Barkley.
But to say I'm not feeling comfortable with him sitting on the sideline crying like that. That makes me uncomfortable. So that tells me he's not in shape to play. I mean, I don't know how this night's going to turn out. But to be sitting on the sideline a few minutes before the game crying, that makes me uncomfortable for him. That's just not a good look, in my personal opinion. I mean,
so you hear what Charles Barkley says by his words, and I wanted you to hear it. I'm going to play it again so you can listen to his tone. As a number of people, as I say, are calling for him to be fired for what he said. I'm not there. I'm not there, and I'm not sure if I'll get there as I analyze this or not. I'm listening for malice. I'm listening to his voice for hatred. I'm listening to his voice for condescension, for something that's a lot more aggressively mean-spirited. Before I would say, you know what, somebody shouldn't have that job anymore. And by the way, it should go without saying, who am I? Who are you? Who are these people online saying somebody shouldn't have the job? It's just they're expressing opinions in the same way he was. But I'm listening for mean-spiritedness. I'm listening for malice. I'm listening for personal harm or an intent to harm Isaiah Thomas. I'm listening for mockery. If I hear any of those things, I'd probably join the chorus of people saying, you know what, TNT, you got to dump Chuck. And I like Chuck, for the most part. I really do. If I hear mockery in his voice, I'm going to say, this dude's got to go. If I hear malice or mean-spiritedness, I'm going to say, this guy's got to go. First time I played it for you, I didn't hear those things. Listen again for yourself and tell me if you hear mean-spiritedness, malice, mockery, hatred, those kinds of things in his voice. And I apologize one more time. Here we go.
But to say I'm not feeling comfortable with him sitting on the sideline crying like that, that makes me uncomfortable. So that tells me he's not in shape to play. I mean, I don't know how this night's going to turn out. But to be sitting on the sideline a few minutes before the game crying, that makes me uncomfortable for him. That's just not a good look, in my personal opinion.
I'm still not finding it. I'm not finding malice. I'm not finding personal intent to injure or intent to harm. He said it very clearly. In my personal opinion, I'm not comfortable. And I think he's speaking as an analyst. You know, I don't think he's judging the man as a man. I think he's judging him as an analyst, meaning as an analyst judging how Isaiah Thomas is going to play. I'm not comfortable with him crying on the sidelines a few minutes before the game. He said, we're going to see how tonight goes, but I'm not comfortable. When he says we're going to see how tonight goes, I think he means the guy isn't ready emotionally to play the game. He probably shouldn't be. That's my takeaway. My takeaway is, again, not from a place of hatred or anger, but he's evaluating whether or not the guy should play. Remember, he is an analyst on TNT's set. It's his job to give his opinion. And if he sees Isaiah Thomas crying, maybe the first thing out of his mouth should be sympathy. So sorry for his loss. But then when it comes time to analyze, you know, how do you think this will impact his game? And I don't know. Maybe the question was asked Ernie Johnson before. I wish I had more context of this. Maybe Ernie said, what do you think? How do you think he'll play given where he is right now? Look at him on the sideline. And Charles Barkley saying, I'm not comfortable with it. We'll see how it goes, but it doesn't look like maybe he's ready to play. Maybe that's just an analyst's opinion. And it's not an angry, malicious one filled with, you know, hurtful intentions. I don't think it was filled with hurtful intentions. As clumsy and as clunky and as awkward maybe as he phrased it, but he said clearly, I'm not comfortable seeing him like that. It's a bad look. We'll see how tonight goes, but maybe he's not ready to play.
But to say I'm not feeling comfortable with him sitting on the sideline crying like that, that makes me uncomfortable. So that tells me he's not in shape to play.
That's an analyst's opinion. I mean, is the anger really, really justified at Charles Barkley here? When he's just giving his opinion as to whether or not he's ready to play? I mean, Twitter was all over this. Twitter was all over Charles Barkley, and they were merciless. Charles Barkley's comments in regards to Isaiah Thomas are disgraceful. He should be fired from at NBA on TNT immediately. No questions asked. Well, I disagree. Because I'm asking some questions right now. Was it malicious? Was it hateful? Was it hurtful? Was it in a mocking tone? Or was he answering a question or addressing an issue about whether or not Isaiah Thomas should be playing tonight, given his emotional state? He said, I'm not comfortable with how he's crying over there because it indicates that maybe he's not able to play. It's not a good look.
But to say, I'm not feeling comfortable with him sitting on the sideline crying like that, that makes me uncomfortable. So that tells me he's not in shape to play.
He's not in shape to play. Obviously not physically in shape, mentally, emotionally. He's not ready to play. And he said, well, we'll see how tonight goes.
I mean, I don't know how this night's going to turn out. But to be sitting on the sideline a few minutes before the game crying, that makes me uncomfortable for him. That's just not a good look, in my personal opinion. I mean,
in my personal opinion. What, he's not allowed to give a personal opinion right now? If he'd have said, listen, let's turn this story just a hair. If Charles Barkley's on national television describing Isaiah Thomas sitting on the sideline crying in the pregame shoot-around, and he says, I'm not comfortable with Isaiah Thomas sitting over there crying. It's playoff time. It's time to man up. Put all that personal stuff aside. Worry about your sister after the game. But this is playoff time, and your team needs you, and that's a bad look sitting over there. Come on, man. Man up. I'm not comfortable with that. That's my personal opinion. Now, if he had said something vaguely resembling what I just made up, now I got a problem. He didn't mock Isaiah Thomas's tears. He didn't mock the family situation. He said simply, I'm not comfortable with him crying on the sideline a few minutes before the game because it indicates to me that maybe he's not able to play. And if he's not ready to play, then maybe he shouldn't be playing tonight. And nobody would blame him. He lost a member of his immediate family, his younger sister, in a terrible accident. Nobody would blame him if he didn't play. Maybe that's what Charles Barkley's saying. From an analyst's point of view, is the best player on the Celtics going to be able to go tonight? I don't know. But if he goes and he's not right in the right frame of mind, maybe he shouldn't go. And I'm seeing him over there on the sideline right now, and that's not the right frame of mind because he looks very, very upset, very, very emotional, and that doesn't make me comfortable about his ability to be able to play tonight. I don't think there's malice.
I mean, I don't know how this night's going to turn out, but to be sitting on the sideline.
Now, I wanted to hear the whole thing again. Hold on a second. From the beginning.
I mean, I don't know how this night's going to turn out, but to be sitting on the sideline.
It's not it either. Apologize. I'm just trying to get it all the way back to the beginning. One more time.
But to say, I'm not feeling comfortable with him sitting on the sideline crying like that, that makes me uncomfortable. So that tells me he's not in shape to play.
I don't see the malice. I don't see the anger. I don't see the rage. I don't see the mockery. He's saying, I'm not comfortable seeing this a few minutes before the game because he's not ready to play. If he's not ready to play, maybe he shouldn't play. That's an analyst's job.
Yeah.
Jim, how'd you see it?
I'm not really hearing any malice or anything like that either. And, you know, as for those on Twitter calling for Barkley's head, the only thing I could think of is, well, you know, haters are just going to hate. And if you're talking specifically about Barkley, there's probably 5 to 10 other things we could brainstorm for a minute that were kind of worse than what we just heard there. And the, honestly, having listened to it a bunch of times, I'm not hearing malice either. It's Charles Barkley fumbling his way through saying it from an analytical point of view. And on that front, by the way, he was wrong, because in that game, despite the loss, Isaiah Thomas went 33 points, 5 rebounds, 6 assists, had a steal, 10 of 18 from the floor, 10 of 12 from the line, 3 of 7 from downtown. So he turned out okay in terms of playing the game. His team lost, of course.
Right.
But I'm not sensing any real malice there. The haters got to cool off on this one. I'm sure in a couple weeks Barkley will say something that's much more legitimate for you guys.
Well, and you know, that's the thing. You know, you're talking about a guy who's already a lightning rod. Charles Barkley's already a lightning rod for controversy, and the people who hate him for other things he has said in the past, this is just a, oh my God, over the top
moment. There he goes again!
Right. And so it puts them over the top. For those who are a little bit more balanced about it, and who maybe have liked some things he has said in the past, haven't liked some things he said in the past, and are willing to be, fair and equitable in their evaluation of each instance.
And I say both of us fit into that boat.
I try to be, because I have been upset about things he said in the past. But I have also been very supportive of things he said in the past, and I'm very fair and equitable, I think, about what he says. I think what he said here can be taken the wrong way if you're looking to take something the wrong way. But I also think it's something that's very fair and legitimate in questioning whether or not somebody is ready emotionally and fit to play.
Especially pregame, which is when this was. We didn't know how Thomas and that game was going to turn out. I gave you a stat line. The only bad part for Isaiah Thomas is the Bulls got the upset win.
There you go. So here's what we're going to do. Take time out of here. Top of the hour. Sports Center coming your way. We're going to talk to Maniloff about that. The Cavaliers' first round game one win that was nearly a loss. About Paul George and whether he was right. About Charles Barkley and whether or not he was right. About Westbrook versus Harden and who was right there. And much, much more. And, of course, about the Tigers taking the measure of the Indians in 2 out of 3 in a weekend series. A year after getting hammered by the Indians night after night after night. Are things different in 2017, or is this just a little early, a little too early to decide that? We'll get into all that with Maniloff coming up right here on The Ticket.
James after Channing Frye for three, puts it in. Largest lead of the game. Loses it to James. 2-on-1. Jefferson back to James. Lance Stephenson gets inside. Nice soft touch. Lance Stephenson nails it. Stephenson sees it opening, left-handed, lays it in. George fakes. Kicks it out. Teague for three. Knocks it down. Jeff Teague makes it a 4-point game. Teague steps back, 3-pointer, puts it in. And the first lead for the Pacers. James on the drive to the rim. Irvin splits the defense. Elbow jumper's good. George, long 3-pointer. It's good. Paul George. James hovering. Goes to double team. They look to get it out of George's hands. 4 seconds to go. Miles puts up the jumper. Won't go. Game over. Cavs survive.
You know, I thought overall defensively we were pretty good, just outside of the loose balls they got, scored the basketball, offensive rebounds, putbacks, you know, the 50-50 balls that we didn't get to, they scored on. You know, just clean those things up. It had been a different game. You know, 11 turnovers for 19 points, and then missing 13 free throws wasn't good for us either. We found a way to, you know, pull the game out, and, you know, we'll be better.
Offensively, we kind of got a little stagnant and started playing a little bit isolation, which we're very good at. And no matter what happened, we came out with the win. And in a series, I think you get better with time.
They almost was baiting me to throw that. You know, Richard Jefferson was kind of cat and mousing it. And I told Lance he had to flash up. That would have been the ball game right there. You know, Richard can't guard both of those, CJ and Lance. But he didn't do so. I gave it up, you know, to soften him up and try to get it back. I talked to CJ about it. Situations like that, I got to get the last shot.
Utah has a timeout. Gets it across half court. Won't use the timeout. 5 seconds left. Joe Johnson with 4. Johnson with 2. Drives in. Puts it up. Gets the bounce at the gun. And the Jazz win game one. ISO Joe.
Honestly, I was supposed to take the ball out. I think Faye just kind of took the ball out and I was open. I seen George coming trying to get the ball where CP was chasing him. So I just brought the ball up. I remember Joe Ingles setting the pick. Got Jamal Crawford on me. And I just seen the clock going down, so I know I had to make a play. I just wanted to get as close as I could to the basket. You know, it's a good thing it went down.
The 1-1. Fly ball right field. Ball hit pretty well. This ball's going to carry, and it is gone. It's out of here. A home run for Miguel Cabrera.
A fly ball. Deep center. Beck is robot.
Avilo sends it high in the air and deep into right field, way back, and the Red Hot start continues.
continues for Avila.
Look out, Alexander.
He hit a bomb to right center field, a two-run shot, and the Tigers have the lead.
Wow.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
All righty then, it's 4:12. Thanks for staying with us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. A little bit of everything in the montage there, with the exception of somebody in the NFL draft. That is one of the things we're going to talk to our good friend Dennis Maniloff about now as he joins us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. D-Man, how you doing, my friend? Hope you had a nice Easter weekend.
Yes, you too, Bob, and to Kush and everybody over there.
Gorgeous weekend, it was indeed, and a lot of great stuff happening in the sports world over the weekend as well, and that's what we want to break down with you. Let's get the thing that didn't happen yet out of the way first, Dennis. Then we'll talk about the Tigers taking the measure of the Indians two times out of three at home in a very slow start to the home schedule for the Wahoos. And then we'll get into the NBA and the Cavaliers game number two tonight, as well as some of the other first game matchups and how things turned out. But the thing that didn't happen yet is the draft. It is coming up, obviously, 10 days away. I don't know if you're actually going to do a mock. Have you done a mock draft, Dennis Maniloff?
I have not. No, only mentally.
Mentally. Now, do you plan to publish one?
Online. What's that?
Do you plan to publish a mock draft in your column?
No, I do not. No.
Okay.
I've made my points very clear on the draft, and I don't do a mock.
Okay, well, that's fine. Then make your points clear to me, because I don't know what they are. You don't have to do a mock, but tell me what you think is going to happen with the number one overall pick, and then obviously the Browns in that luxurious position of having the number 12 as well.
Yeah, with all the talk about the Browns potentially doing something.
Can you make him louder for me, Jim Cushlin? If I can't hear him, chances are nobody else can either. Make that
I'm
a little bit louder.
I'm screaming at my man, Bob France.
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me now?
I can now. Yes, sir.
All right, I'm trying my best.
Thank you, brother.
Listen, as we know, the run-up to the draft is silly season. There's so much time that people have to virtually invent scenarios. I think ultimately the Browns will do the right thing, the common sense thing, and take Myles Garrett, number one overall, the best player in the draft. You take him, you relax the rest of the way, you know, relatively speaking. I mean, of course you're going to have nervous moments here or there, but once you get that best player in the draft, you don't have to feel as much pressure. I think that's the better way to put it. So that's number one. And then at 12, you know, obviously it looks like they want to get a quarterback out of this draft class, and they want to do it fairly soon. They don't want to get like a fourth round projection guy. So if that's the case and they feel like one of those guys is going to get snatched up, picks 2 to 11, then you trade up, you use your ammunition to get up there and get them. Do the best you can to get them. And if that falls through somehow, you take the best player available at 12. You know, I'm thinking about a guy like O.J. Howard, although he might not even be around, the tight end from Alabama. If you come out of there with Garrett and Howard at 1 and 12, you have two starters on opening day of their rookie seasons. And, you know, I don't think you can ask for much more out of your first round.
Two things. Number one, what do you make of the recent reports of a split in the Browns front office between Mitch Trubisky at number one and Myles Garrett at number one? It seems that's the only quarterback they're talking about is Trubisky, not Watson or Kaiser.
Yeah, Bob, the first thing I do when I hear these rumors or read about them is, where are they coming from? Who are the people that are peddling the rumors or the, you know, the reports? And these are credible people that have been saying this. So I'm sure there's something behind it. But to me, rather than say it's some, you know, incredible gulf in thinking, why can't it just be normal debate, you know, normal hashing out of thought? And, you know, I'm sure there's a part of the front office of the Browns and, you know, maybe even Haslam that says, I want player A, be it Garrett, and then another part says, I want player B, Trubisky, or perhaps some other person we're not thinking of. So that, to me, is normal. That's healthy. It doesn't necessarily mean you have division, but ultimately I think they sit down and they recognize that they need to come out of this draft with Myles Garrett at number one overall.
I've got a problem with Myles Garrett. I've said it to other people. I've said it on this show, but I haven't said it to you, and I'll just throw it at you. It's very simple. I don't want a diva. I don't want a diva at the number one pick. I sense diva-like, wide receiver-like diva qualities in Myles Garrett. He wouldn't even sit down and do an interview with Greenberg and Golic because Golic was out and Anthony Booger McFarland was in. And Booger McFarland has criticized him before, saying he might not play the run as well as a guy who goes number one overall should play the run and might not be up for the collisions because he has watched a lot of tape on him and said that. He wouldn't even take he wouldn't even do the interview because somebody was being critical of him. Then when he did another interview while on the tour of Bristol, Connecticut, with Russillo and Cannell, they asked him about why he wouldn't do the interview with Mike and Mike, and his father and his agent were livid. How dare you ask him a question like that? I hear a guy's got that thin of skin, and he's surrounded by that kind of advisors, those kind of advisors, who are livid that somebody would dare ask him a negative question or a critical question. I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't want a diva. I don't want a guy who's too thin-skinned, who can't stand criticism. What's he going to do if he doesn't get 10 sacks his rookie year? And the sports talkers and the columnists like you and the writers all, you know, go off on the underperforming Myles Garrett in his rookie season. How's he going to handle that?
Well, listen, I hear your points, Bob, but I'm going to counter that by saying, you know, a lot of what I've read and heard about Garrett is that he's a very good guy, that he is a hard worker. If you're a slacker, you don't go into the combine and do what he did, as an example, okay? If you're a slacker and you don't care, you do not play in the bowl game against Kansas State on one ankle with the high ankle sprain that he had. And people, including me, initially were like, geez, what's all the fuss about Myles Garrett? When, as I watched him not really moving well in that game, I said, you know, he's being handled. Well, the truth comes out. He's playing with a bum ankle. You heard some guys that, or you knew that some top flight guys didn't even play in the bowl game. He did. So I put that as a check mark in the plus column.
But how is he going to handle criticism if he won't even sit down for an interview because somebody has been critical of him? I mean, that's not a strong-willed guy, you ask me.
All right, well, honestly, Bob, I don't know the full story there. I don't know how deep that runs, if there's anything further to that. But I will say this. Let's suppose what you're saying is true and he is thin-skinned. Okay, the Browns take him, and he's their property for a number of years. He's under their control for a number of years, and he at least is going to start his NFL career with Greg Williams, who is a no-nonsense, hard-nosed defensive coordinator. You know what? Even if he is thin-skinned, he's going to have to grow up real quick if he wants to do anything. And if he cares about his NFL career and wants to make money down the road, because we know that thanks to the collective bargaining, they don't make their real money in the first contract, that he's going to have to put the work in. And I just don't think it's going to be a problem. I don't see it as an issue. If he does have diva-like qualities, they're going to be flushed out of him in a hurry in the first training camp under Greg Williams.
Fair enough. Dennis Manilow, we're just talking about the NFL draft. And so do you think that it will be Trubisky at 12 then if they don't find a way to get a Garoppolo trade done or something like that?
Listen, Bob, I think my gut tells me, just reading and listening, that Trubisky's gone before 12. It's just the way it goes, even though he would be way overvalued in most people's eyes, if he went, in the top half of the first round. It's the way it goes with quarterbacks in the draft. Oftentimes, they get overvalued. Some team, I'm not going to say panics, but some team gets eager and grabs one, and then there's a run on them, and all of a sudden you say, well, how did this quarterback class go so high on average? So I think Trubisky goes earlier than 12. I think that might be the source of maybe this, nervousness that maybe a Hugh Jackson or somebody else has with the Browns, that, hey, if we sit and wait for him at 12, he's not going to be there. So if we really want him, we're going to have to trade him to get him. So that's my feeling. I mean, if you really want Trubisky, you're probably going to have to trade up to get him if you're the Browns,
okay,
at 12.
Fair enough, Dennis Mantiloff. Let's move to the next ball. They were pitching. They weren't hitting. And they really, well, they hit Justin Verlander just fine. Talking about the Indians, they beat up their number one whipping boy. It's amazing how Verlander, early in his career, could not be touched by the Indians. And now for the last several seasons, he can't get them out to save his life. A career-high 9 earned runs allowed. But he's the only guy the Indians were able to hit in this homestand, essentially. Tigers took 2 out of 3. They're in first place. Indians are in last place, 3 games back now. It's April 17th. I realize that. Nobody's pushing any panic buttons. But what are you seeing there, and what does that particular series tell you about, you know, the difference in 2017 from 2016 when the Indians owned the Tigers?
Well, yeah, I picked the Tigers to win the division, and, you know, I got just grilled and drilled and filleted and sauteed on Twitter and email and text. How dare you? Didn't you watch the games last year? How could you pick the Tigers to beat the mighty Indians who took the Cubs to the extra innings of Game 7 of the World Series? You know what? I mean, I didn't take it because I loved the Tigers. I didn't take it because I disliked the Indians. I said there's going to be a three-way race in the division, and the Royals will also be in the mix. And the reason I took the Tigers is because I have a tremendous amount of respect for their lineup, and they showed some of that over the weekend. They don't even have J.D. Martinez, so this is going to be a very difficult lineup to deal with when Martinez gets back. It already is. And I like their pitching better than a lot of people do, and, you know, Daniel Norris and Matthew Boyd showed me what I thought they would show me over the weekend, and I think those are two solid lefties to go with the other three righties in the rotation. So the Tigers, in my mind, were a good team last year. They went 86-75, and, oh, by the way, 4-14 against the Indians. So if you're the Tigers, you say, you know what, if we play 500 ball against the Indians, we possibly win the division. And I get it. The Indians deserve credit for going 14-4 against the Tigers last year, but season series, to me, are very fluctuating. And already the Tigers are halfway to that four victory total after this past weekend. So I respect the Tigers more than a lot of people do around here. As far as the Indians go, you know, I see an issue at the bottom of their order. I'm not saying other teams don't have that issue. I'm not saying it can't crop up with the Tigers as well. But guys like Gomes make me nervous. The center field position makes me nervous for the Indians. Not sure about right field, you know, certainly. And then the other part that makes me nervous if I'm an Indians fan is 3, 4, 5 in the rotation. I just don't have faith that Salazar, Tomlin, and Bauer are going to be able to give you consistently good performances over the course of a year. None of the three has proven to be able to do that. And until they do, I'm not going to be over the moon about the Indians and guarantee you that they're going to win 90-95 games.
Yeah, and I certainly understand the over the moon part. I feel like it should be better than some of what you just said, but I can't swear to it because, you know, we haven't seen it on a season long basis from some of the guys, especially when you talked about the 3, 4, 5 spots in the order, either from a health standpoint or a consistent performance standpoint. So it's fair game. And you also make great points about the Tigers. I also don't think they're going to be as good as they were against the Indians, save for Verlander, obviously. I don't think they're built that way right now, but I think they're obviously off to a good start, and we'll have to see as the next month or so goes. What do they say? What do we say each and every year? You are what you're going to be by, what, the 40-game mark? Is that kind of the bellwether point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a generally accepted one. I mean, and I look at probably the end of May, because, look, remember last year. We don't have to go any further back than last year, Bob, when, and I think it was May 9th, the Indians were fourth place and I believe 5 or 6 back of the mighty Chicago White Sox. Okay? Remember that start the White Sox got off to, like 22-10 or something like that? Well, guess what? That didn't hold up. The White Sox fell off the map, and the Indians wind up winning 94 games. So it is very early. Indians played 12 games at 7.4% of a 162-game season. There's plenty of time to get it right. However, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be a little concerned, like I said, about the back of the rotation and things like that. And the Tigers, I think they had to, you know, they needed to play well over the weekend in Cleveland for their own psyches. You know, if they'd have gone into Cleveland and gotten boat raced three times in a row, then all of a sudden they're going, all right, are we any good? Do we have a chance to hang? The Indians are, they own us. And instead they won two out of three. They know that the hiccup was Verlander, who they figure will get it right. And he has been very good. So it was more important for the Tigers to play well, which they did. And, you know, I think the Tigers are going to be around for the remainder of the year.
All right, Dennis Maniloff of the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Let's put that ball away and take out the bigger one now. Game number two tonight, it was a colossal escape is what I'm going to call it for the Cavaliers in game number one. They had a 12-point lead at the end of the third quarter. They blew a 10-point lead midway through the fourth quarter. They gave up the lead and actually trailed by two before finally surviving C.J. Miles' brick at the end, which could have been the game winner. Paul George says, I should have had that shot. I've got to get that ball back there. And you know what? He was 6 out of 8 from three. The way he was stroking the ball, I feel like it was, you know, they owe C.J. Miles I would say a Christmas card, but an April card, a thank you card, because if Paul George would have taken that shot, it's probably 1-0 Indiana right now. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to say it's weak on Paul George's part to call out his teammate like that after the game. I mean, come on, if you're a real leader, you don't do that. You do that behind the scenes. You don't undress him in front of the media after game one that you lost. And by the way, Paul, I mean, if you really want the ball at the end, you keep it. You do not pass the ball to C.J. Miles with like 6 seconds left and expect to get the ball back. So I'm not sitting here being sympathetic to Paul George's plight that he, you know, expected the ball back and C.J. knows better and we talked about it. But having said all that, listen, I'm not comfortable watching the Cavaliers. I'm no more comfortable watching them now than I was a week ago, 2 weeks ago, a month, 2 months ago. I mean, this team, you're right, it was an escape. C.J. Miles' shot was online. He's better from 23 feet against the Cavs than he is from 16 or 17.
No doubt.
So they got fortunate there. But listen, I'm not going to trust in this version of the Cavaliers until I see them put together not one, but at least two good games in a row. And to me, what they did the other night was not a good game. I mean, yes, they won, granted. So that part is important. As LeBron said, it doesn't matter how. But in a sense, though, it does matter with these guys because they are the defending champs. They haven't been playing well for several months. So style points do matter, and you can tell with your eyes if this team is right. And my eyes told me in game one that this team is not right. Does it mean that it can't happen? Of course not. It can happen, but it didn't happen in game one. So, you know, we'll see, but right now my confidence level in the Cavaliers is no higher after game one victory than it was before.
Having said that, do they win game two?
I don't want to be pessimistic, Pete, but I don't think so. I think they lose game two. I just think their bad habits are going to creep up again. I think it'll be a close game, and this time the Pacers will figure out a way to win. Does it mean I think the Cavs lose the series? No. But I just don't think that the Cavaliers have figured out what they need to figure out yet, and that it will come back to bite them tonight.
A couple of other quick NBA notes, because I know you've got to go. Last night, game one, Harden versus Westbrook. I know the regular season award is a regular season award, so nothing that happened last night can impact anybody's vote. However, last night was, for me, an example of why I voted, if I had a vote.
I knew it was.
Why I voted for James Harden. He makes, and did so last night, everybody around him better. Not to the level that LeBron James does, don't get me wrong. And he doesn't play the defense that some of the other great players in the league play. But he makes his team better, and he did so last night. Russell Westbrook trying to do everything himself, 9 turnovers. It's just an example of why I give the nod to James Harden. What do you see there?
I'm not going to argue with you based on last night. I mean, you know, I told you the last time I was on with you, Bob, that it's a worthwhile debate. Both guys have points you can make in their favor for sure for MVP. And yes, the voting is turned in before the postseason, so you shouldn't hold any postseason against the guy. But what you say about Harden, you know, gets validated on a game like last night, even though it wouldn't count in the overall voting criteria. It shows what you're talking about, and I'm sure Harden is like, okay, you know, I'm assuming you guys voted for Russell Westbrook for MVP. Well, if you did, watch this, you know, and you'll see what you missed on. You know, Harden and the Rockets, I believe, are a bad matchup for the Thunder anyway. Even if Westbrook is on his game, I think they're hard pressed to beat the Rockets. So I don't think it's gonna look good for Russell Westbrook the remainder of this series.
Yeah, I don't either. And last thing, Dennis, and I'll let you run with this. There are a lot of haters, and I don't know where you are on Charles Barkley. I don't know if you and I have ever actually discussed him in full. To me, he, you know, being as boisterous as he is and being in the opinion-giving business that he is in and has been since retirement, I have had things that he has said that has made me outraged and things that I have completely defended that other people have been outraged over. So here we are. I think those who hate him and who have been outraged by him in the past are the ones who are calling for his firing. After this remark about Isaiah Thomas sitting in tears on the sideline during shoot-around before game one between the Celtics and the Bulls.
But to say I'm not feeling comfortable with him sitting on the sideline crying like that, that makes me uncomfortable. So that tells me he's not in shape to play. I mean, I don't know how this night is going to turn out. But to be sitting on the sideline a few minutes before the game crying, that makes me uncomfortable for him.
So people are saying that TNT should fire Charles Barkley over that. For me, Dennis, I was listening for malice. I was listening for mockery. I was listening for mean-spiritedness. I did not hear any of those things. It wasn't the nicest thing to say, but I think he was trying to analyze whether or not Thomas was ready to play. And being the fact that he was in tears during shoot-around, maybe he's not ready to play. That's what I heard. What did you hear?
Yeah, Bob, on the Charles Barkley shock jock meter, 10 being outrageous, 1 being tame, it's maybe right in the middle. It's a 5. It's not outrageous. I think he was genuinely expressing, you know, what he believed was Isaiah Thomas's mindset. I didn't hear any malice. I didn't hear any, you know, outrage or saying something for the sake of ratings.
Right.
And you got to remember too that Charles Barkley's in the same studio as Ernie Johnson, who's been through like hell and back 6 times with his personal life. So if anyone, you know, or if any group of guys is going to have sympathy for Isaiah Thomas, it's going to be that crew, you know, with Kenny and Shaq and Johnson and Charles. So no, I don't see it. I don't see that what he said was outrageous or insensitive. He was trying to be analytical. He was trying to clinically analyze what he thought was the case. And, you know, I felt, if anything, the way he spoke, it sounded like he was being, you know, he was sorry about what was happening for Thomas and that he wished that it didn't have to happen, of course.
From a result standpoint, Isaiah Thomas had a very good game, scored 33 points, but lost. Any chance that the Bulls take down the number one seed Celtics in this series, or is that just that's the game they're going to get and Boston's going to come back at them?
There's absolutely a chance the Bulls can take this series. They do a lot of things that cause the Celtics trouble. They have length, they have quickness, they can defend, they're grimy on the defensive side. They have a guy like Jimmy Butler, and of course the veterans like Wade and Rondo, and they can shoot some threes if Bobby Portis is on fire. Absolutely, they can win the series. They've got home court now. They got tremendous confidence. They're playing with house money, if you will, because nobody thought they would be here in the first place. Now that game one is in the books, I see the Bulls coming out of this series with the victory, because there's going to be tremendous pressure on the Celtics in game two. Even if it goes 1-1 back to Chicago, I don't see why the Bulls can't win both games in Chicago to go up 3-1. So I see the Bulls winning this series thanks to what they did in game one.
Dennis, great breakdown as it always is. We'll have to leave it there. We can't get to all the series in one conversation. Thanks so much for your time, my friend. I really appreciate you reworking your schedule, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Dennis. Dennis Manilov joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. You want to react to some of that, some of his thoughts, some of my thoughts? By all means, dial us up at 866-240-1065. Hey, remember I mentioned going out golfing earlier because it was such a beautiful weekend? If your clubs are cleaned up and ready to go and the only thing you don't have is the place you want to play at, can I tell you about Brandywine, the all-inclusive private country club in Northwest Ohio? The only one that's all-inclusive. That's right. You know, people are always taking all-inclusive vacations to save money. Well, at Brandywine, you're on a constant all-inclusive vacation. Unlimited golf, cart, pool, fitness, all the social events, including the amazing pool parties that they have there at Brandywine. The new Brandywine Country Club, without even knowing it, they're changing how traditional country clubs compete in this market. They're doing an amazing job thinking outside the box with one low all-inclusive price. And there's a great deal for you now if you get in on this by the end of May. I'll tell you about that in a second, but it's so refreshing to play this club, a private club where there's no surprises. The new Brandywine features 18 holes of Arthur Hills Design Championship Golf and a layout that is spectacular. It's a par 72. There's now three par fives on the front nine, total yardage of 6639. It is playable for everybody, but a challenge for great golfers as well, especially if you want to play them from the tips. And one of the best things about joining the all-inclusive private Brandywine Club is you never have to wait for leagues to get out of the way. Why? Because there is only one league at Brandywine, yours. You play when you want. And don't forget about the amazing restaurant, too. Champions Bar and Grill reopened in the summer of last year, 2016. It is now open to the public. That's correct. Call 419-865-2393 for all of the details. And if you join, here's the deal I was telling you about. If you join Brandywine, the only all-inclusive private country club in Northwest Ohio, by May 31st, they will waive your initiation fee. That's right. Join me on the course and join me at the club this year at Brandywine, 419-865-2393. Tell them Bob France told you to call. They're going to take great care of you at the all-new, all-inclusive Brandywine Country Club. And we're right back with some of your calls after this. Indeed, final segment of the extravaganza on this Monday afternoon. Appreciate you being a part of it. If you want to join us and talk about what we've been discussing, rather than just sit and listen to it, by all means, dial us up at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. By the way, that's the number I'm going to ask you to call at the end of the show as well when it's time for our next Orlando Flyaway qualifier for the grand prize of a trip to Florida. But don't dial yet, at least not for the contest, because it is not yet time for that. So what in the world do you think is going on, Kush, with Verlander? You know, we talked a ton of basketball. Excuse me. And I got all three sports in with Manilov because he's a general sports writer, so it's great to be able to hit all of those things with him. Why is Justin Verlander absolutely unable to get Indians out? And there was a time, you know, again, up until about 3-4 years ago, where it was the other way around.
Yep.
Where the Indians could not touch Justin Verlander. I mean, if they faced him, it was just over. And now he can't get them out. And I don't have his game-by-game log against the Indians in front of me at the moment, but we all know that it's very similar to what just happened on Saturday when he got lit up for 9 earned runs in what, 3 innings? Three and a third, something like that?
Yeah, it was he did go 4 9 runs, 11 hits.
9 earned runs, all of them earned. 11
that was a career hits, high, by the way, against the Indians.
A career high, yeah, exactly. Let's put it to you this way. He went into the game, did Justin Verlander, with an ERA of 1.35. He left with an ERA of 5.71 over three starts. So just to kind of throw out, what do you think it is? I'm looking at an article here. Before you answer, I'm looking at an article here on .com, ESPN.com, about pitch tipping. And he isn't, we're worried, you know, some other people apparently are, but he isn't worried about it. He's kind of making light about it, that he's tipping his pitches. He tweeted a picture of himself sitting in the pool drinking a cold one, and it says he tweeted, "Working on my tipping." hashtag no off days, And, you know, of course, he's just chilling there, tipping a cold one. It looks like a Corona, I want to say, from the bottle. But I could be wrong.
Kudos to him for having a sense of humor about that.
Well,
by the way.
And you know what? At the end of the day, he walked off of that mound after four innings into a shower, and then afterwards got into a car or an Uber or whatever. Well, I guess he was in Cleveland, but walked into the waiting arms of one of the most beautiful women in the world. And a pool.
It always comes back to that, by the way, when you're trying to feel bad for Justin Verlander, then you have to remind yourself of that.
I mean, seriously, Kate Upton is one of the most – I mean, how many times has she been two or three different times the cover girl for the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition?
Sure.
She's one of the sexiest women in the world, and she's all Justin. So, you know what? I gave up 9 earned runs today. Think I'm feeling bad? I got a pool, a Corona, and Kate. So have a nice day, everybody. But, no, Brad Ausmus and James McCann, the catcher, changed their signals throughout the game as a precaution against signs being stolen.
Right.
There's some concerns that maybe signs are being stolen or that maybe he was tipping his pitches. And that's what McCann said on Sunday, so yesterday. Quote, we use multiple signs with nobody on base. We change our signs often. It's got to be something other than that. Talking about sign stealing. It's got to be something other than that. It's got to be maybe tipping pitches. Terry Francona, for his part, said, no, we are not stealing signs. I'm just happy when our guys get our signs. And I'm being serious about that, let alone try to pick up other teams.
Nice.
But ask if he thought Verlander might be tipping his pitches. Ausmus said, could be. You know, so you got catchers all over the place here with McCann saying this, as well as Ausmus, that, you know, he might be tipping his pitches. Hitters, here's a quote from Brad Ausmus. Hitters are always trying to find an edge on pitchers. And looking for a pitcher tipping is standard operating procedure. I can't tell you whether he is or he isn't. Only the Indians could tell you that, and they probably won't. This is what he said to MLive.com, as quoted by ESPN. So I'm just wondering if there isn't something to that. You know, this is a very bizarre thing that, you know, even Ausmus is a former catcher. He and McCann, these guys know this sort of thing. There's no real other explanation to justify how Justin Verlander is just getting shelled by the Indians every time he faces them.
Yeah, it is one of those interesting things, and especially in the context of at the earlier stages of Verlander's career versus the Indians. He was as lights out against them as pretty much everybody else, essentially. But yeah, something seemed to have happened in the last couple of years, and for whatever reason, Justin Verlander can't seem to get Cleveland Indians out. As for the tipping pitches hypothesis, that could be. I mean, pitchers occasionally, this will happen to them. It's a different motion, or if you're a hitter and you're looking carefully, you could maybe see the different arm angles. Old school stories used to say that Sandy Koufax was always tipping his pitches. Every hitter knew if it was a fastball or a curve, but it was Sandy Koufax, so both pitches were so good nobody could really hit him anyway. So this isn't uncommon, and if that's part of the reason that the Indians have had success, then that's a mechanics thing that Verlander might have to work on.
The game log, though, for last year is interesting, because you would think that maybe, based on his last two starts against Cleveland last year in September, he had figured it out. He lost to them 1-0 on September 17th, but he went 7 innings, 1 hit, no runs, struck out 7, walked 4. 10 days later, he faced them again at home, and in a 12-0 rout, he went 7 2/3, 4 hits, no runs. That's a combined 14 2/3 innings without allowing an earned run by the Indians. So it looked like maybe he'd figured it out. And just, again, going back into last year and previous outings against them, in June, the previous one, or the most previous one, if that's the right way to say it, which it isn't, to the ones that I just gave you the numbers on, June 26th, 4 2/3, 9 hits, 8 runs, all of them earned. Prior to that, in May, he faced them at Cleveland, lost 5 innings, 8 runs, 7 hits, or excuse me, 8 hits, 7 runs, all 7 of them earned. Going back into 2016. So let me just grab 2015 real quick. Maybe not that this is news to anybody. We all kind of know what the situation has been, but the numbers are staggering. September 13th, lost to them 7-2, 6 innings, 6 hits, 4 runs, all of them earned in a 7-2 loss. Let's see, go back again. June 13th, he only went five innings, three hits, two runs. I don't know if that was an injury situation or what, why he only went five, because it wasn't that bad at that point in time. 2014, this will be the last one because I don't want to go too much further. Won 6-4, but went 5 2/3, gave up six hits, three runs, all of them earned. So that's actually a quality start if you're keeping score that way. Let's see. Lost 6-2, six innings, 11 hits, five runs, all of them earned. Let's see. Won 7-5, five innings, six hits, three runs, none of them earned. So that's a little bit better. So anyway, the numbers are, you know, kind of all over the place, but there was a point in time where you could pencil him for 7 or 8, if not a complete game, of five hits or less and two runs or less against the Indians. He dominated them from probably, I want to say, 08 to through maybe 2012, 13, and it's only been in the last like 3 or 4 years that the Indians have just gotten his number and they tattoo him almost on a regular basis.
Yeah, it is one of those things that if it's not the tipping pitches, then I sure as heck don't know what it is, because baseball, as we know, can be funky like this. But then again, on the other side of this, because this is an interesting question to bring back up, next couple of Verlander starts, even if they're not against the Indians, because, you know, I guarantee you that word gets out to other major league teams. So other major league lineups are going to be looking for this. At the same time, if I'm the Tigers, that's the one bad thing from this weekend. If you're the Tigers, you really overall have to love everything you saw this weekend. Yeah, Miguel Cabrera is a little has some back tightness, but the Tigers are off today, so most likely he'll be in the lineup and fine tomorrow. And unlike Verlander, Miguel Cabrera, he's got the Indians, so now he's hitting a little better.
Yep, no question about it. And that's always a great way to get him going, is to put him up against Indians pitching. All right, that's it. It's all the time that we got. Great conversations today. Really appreciate you being a part of it. Thanks for, even if all you do is sit and listen, we appreciate you doing that. Dial it up anytime you like. Stay where you are and dial up Mike Miller. Drive Time is coming your way next right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. And before we head out the door, I want to give you that other opportunity I promised you, and that is the Orlando Flyaway. Dial it up, 866-240-1065. You and a guest could spend 4 days and 3 nights in Orlando, Florida. Just listen weekdays to this program for the cue to call, or register online once a day at 1065theticket.com. It's all brought to you by the beautiful Orlando Center Marriott. Offer a world of possibilities. Allegiant Air, Shea's Carpet, Toledo Express Airport, Premier Vapor, Country Hearth, and Toledo's ESPN 1065 The Ticket. Caller 5, right now, 866-240-1065. On our way out the door, you are qualified for that grand prize drawing. We'll see you tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.